So for this exploration, you might imagine yourself to be a naturalist going into the wilds. In order to look carefully, to study a particular creature of the wilds. Not to think about it or imagine it or fantasize about it, but to really look at it and sneak up on it and sit very, very quietly and see how it functions, how it works, what it does. What is it? It's an unknown creature, as if you've never seen it before. So to begin, see if you can, as if it's the very first time ever you've discovered it, see if you can discover, what is a thought? So don't think about it, but rather, as you have a thought, study it, look at it in amazement, like a naturalist. What is a thought? How does it work? Some thoughts are more verbal, some are more as images. What's this phenomena of a thought? What is it? What animal is it? What color are thoughts? What shapes? What weight? What texture? How much energy is in a thought? How does a thought behave when you look at it, when it's being observed? If a thought, single thought, is one kind of creature, and thinking is a different kind of creature, what's the difference between a thought and thinking? if the phenomena of thinking is more complex than just having a thought, what are some of the things that come into play, come to bear, are involved in thinking? So let yourself think freely, whatever way your mind wants to think. But like a naturalist, look at thinking. What goes on there? What's the energy level of your thinking? Is it very subtle energy, quiet and calm? Or is it loud and aggressive, insistent? Thinking an isolated event, or are there tentacles that go out from thinking into your muscles, into your feelings, your emotions? Into your impulses, motivations, desires? And if you can step back and observe the phenomena of thinking, even if it's just a little bit more, but kind of observe it as if you're outside, you're a naturalist, how is that different than the way you usually are with your thinking? What's your usual relationship to thinking? Are you inside of it? Is the you of who you are inside your thinking? Is it outside? And then one final exploration. if the thinking part of yourself, of your being, is only, if it was only a very small part of who you are, 1%, 2% of your whole total functioning, could, can you feel your way? Is there a felt sense of the not 98% of who you are, which is not thinking? Without thinking, can you have a direct awareness of your great being, the great aliveness, the great functioning, which is beyond and bigger and wider, more spacious than the thinking itself? Well, I hope at least a few of you were thinking a little bit so you could do that exercise. And those of you who didn't have any thoughts whatsoever during this exercise, well, count your blessings. Some helpful hints from the Colorado Division of Wildlife. Colorado has been home to thoughts since their earliest ancestors evolved in North America. Today, increasing numbers of people routinely live and play in thought country. Learning about thoughts and being aware of their habits will help you fully appreciate these unique animals and the habitat in which they live. What to do if you meet a thought. There is no definite or definitive rule about what to do if you meet a thought. Thought attacks are rare compared to the number of close encounters. However, if you do meet a thought before it has time to leave an area, here are some suggestions. Remember, every situation is different with respect to the thought, the terrain, the people, and their activity. First, stay calm. If you see a thought and it hasn't seen you, calmly leave the area. Two, stop. Back away slowly while facing the thought. Give the thought plenty of room to escape. Wild thoughts rarely attack people unless they feel threatened or provoked. Speak softly. This may reassure the thought that no harm is meant to it. If a thought stands upright or moves closer, it may be trying to detect smells in the air. This isn't a sign of aggression. Once a thought identifies you, it may leave the area and try to intimidate you by charging to within a few feet before it withdraws. Don't run or make any sudden movements. Running is likely to prompt the thought to give chase. And you can't outrun a thought. If you have a potentially life-threatening situation with a thought, or if an injury occurs, please contact the Division of Wildlife Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. I think anyone who is going to meditate, certainly do mindfulness meditation, has to, sooner or later, grapple with thinking. And it's helpful to spend some time, quality time, observing and getting to know your thinking the way it is. I know sometimes it's possible in meditation to always be letting go of thoughts, or turning away from them, or being upset with them, or, you know, why am I thinking again, or, you know, just kind of having all kinds of relationship to them that do not involve studying them, getting to know them better. And one of the principles of mindfulness meditation is that we want to really understand well what it is that occurs, rather than kind of dismissing it or turning away from it. And especially those things which are the obstacles, those things that seem to make meditation difficult, you want to actually turn towards the so-called obstacle and get to know it as best as you can, as opposed to, you know, all the ways pretending it's not there or just ignoring it. Or even if you can let go of the so-called obstacle, if you find yourself letting go of it over and over and over again, and it keeps coming back, then it's a high time that you actually turn and actually study this phenomena, the obstacle, whatever it might be. And to some degree, thinking is a common enough phenomena for most people. And a lot of people find it, thinking is in some way an obstacle for meditation. It doesn't have to be. The meditation texts don't say it is. But often people relate to thinking in a way that they think of it as an obstacle. And so it certainly warrants careful study. What is thinking? Also, thinking is such a huge part of most human life. For some people, it's the only thing going on really in their life. Is thinking, and they don't think that's the case, but really they're just living in a very complex world of thinking, of thoughts, of beliefs, of fantasies, of stories, of projections, of transference. It's all about these words or thoughts or images that occur in the mind. And even though they might see someone out there, they think they're relating to a person out there, 99% of how they're relating to that person is through the filter of their thoughts or an event. There's an event out there that is occurring. 99% of how we relate to the event is through that filter of our thoughts and ideas and stories, interpretations, judgments about that event. Some people spend a lot of time thinking about the future. And the future is only a thought. It's not too real. Beyond just a thought, it's a kind of virtual reality. The original virtual reality is thinking about the future. Someone yesterday said, having expectation is a form of premeditated resentment. I thought that was nice. Premeditated resentment. I guess the idea being you're setting yourself up for resentment. I don't know if it's always the case, but it was a nice little saying. Or spending a lot of time thinking about the past. The past is, in some ways, a different kind of reality than the future, but not much. I mean, it's also mediated or found through our thinking and our thoughts. Many of the ways in which we relate to other people are through the filter of certain kinds of thoughts. One of the little frequent teaching points made in our particular Vipassana tradition involves a teacher some person came to talk to a teacher about some problem that she was having, apparently with her mother. So probably she was going on about difficulties with her mother and this and that and her mother that and this. And then the teacher said, the thought of your mother is not your mother. And that kind of freed the woman up. Mm-hmm. The thought of your mother is not your mother. And certainly mother, there's some biological, I guess, reality to someone being your mother. But your mother is not always your mother. Right? I mean, sometimes she's maybe a wife or a partner or a daughter or, you know, all kinds of other roles. Mothering is kind of like a role. And so that role belongs to a little bit to the world of thoughts and ideas. So who is this person if you're not seeing the person through the idea of motherhood? Who are you? Free of roles, thoughts, ideas. So we see the world very much through the filter of thoughts. We see ourselves through the filter of thoughts. And the thoughts we have are consequential. Sometimes they seem to just flow through idly and have no consequence. But sometimes thoughts seemingly can have these tentacles. That's my word. I don't know if that's, you share that word language. But tentacles, they have this kind of, they're connected to other aspects of our being. So you can be sitting, for example, in meditation, minding your own business very quietly, being very peaceful. Things are serene and nice. And you know, maybe one of these cars drives by on the street here. There's a car. And that car reminds you of the car you had when you were 20. And you had this date in that car. And that person you went on that date with, that person just screwed you over. And suddenly you're fuming. Your anger and your energy is here and you're awake. And how could that person have done that 50 years ago? And it's almost like it was today. And you were minding your own business quietly. And this thought, the idea arose, and that idea was somehow or other had a connection to your emotional life. And it kind of fueled it, kind of turned it on, and jacked you up. It started off with a thought. A story I like to tell is that some years ago, many years ago now, I was teaching a retreat. And there was a woman on the retreat who was known for some years. And all the time I'd known her, she was quite disturbed, upset, angry, a lot of self-criticism, a lot of self-loathing, kind of struggling with it. And one morning, we had a meditation session in the hall. It was just magical. And it was this beautiful, it was like 9:30 in the morning, a beautiful morning light coming in, November light coming in to the retreat center. And the whole meditation hall was really peaceful. It just felt that way. And I felt really peaceful coming out of my meditation. And right after that meditation session, I had an interview with her. And we interviewed in these nice little, very kind of, from my point of view, very peaceful monastic, it was a monastery we had the retreat in. So these monastic cells, you know, where monks live, you know, the bed and the sink and just a little room. And it just was so delightful. I love that kind of place. My monastic blood. And so I was sitting there in this nice little monastic room and I was feeling so peaceful and didn't want to say anything. And then she comes in and takes the chair opposite me, and it was obvious that she was kind of in the same place. She was so peaceful, she was smiling, she was radiant. And I thought, you know, what's happened? This is remarkable. This woman who I've always known as being so worked up. And as we sat there actually for quite a while, just looking at each other, being present, it just felt so delightful, the peace. We both shared this peace. It was so great. And I said something. Eventually, I don't know who broke the silence, but we kind of somehow acknowledged that this was pretty special. And then she said, but it wasn't this way yesterday. Yesterday, I was concerned and upset, and ooh, man, I was really having a hard time. Wow, it was so terrible. Wait, don't go sort of yesterday. Don't give up what you have right now. But, you know, she was pulling these thoughts and these memories out. And those memories and thoughts were tied. And anyway, it was gone. It was really sad. That quickly, she destroyed the peace by reliving the past by thinking of those thoughts. And she felt compelled to tell me that it wasn't always the way it was now. Sometimes she wanted to be apologetic or something was, you know, I don't know what exactly was behind her thinking. So our thoughts are consequential. Some thoughts can weigh us down. Some thoughts are a tremendous drag on our wind drag on our minds, on our energy. They can drain us of energy. You can feel your kind of thing just. And I have a 4-year-old at home, and he's kind of a, must be a born actor. Maybe they all are at that age, but I mean, you know, he just, if he's, you know, like, if you say something like no, his whole body goes. You know, it's so obvious, you know, the effect. Most of us, you know, we're kind of, we don't do so dramatically anymore. It's like, you know, just kind of, you know, we're much more calm about it. But, you know, so they can really just drain our energy. And some energies can boost us up. We feel suddenly energized. And you sit here again, very peaceful and quiet. Or maybe you're sitting here with physical discomfort and struggling with it. And then you suddenly, some beautiful thought, maybe memory arises, or beautiful fantasy arises. There's not a few people who've come on retreats and told me something like, I was having this beautiful fantasy, maybe a series of them, maybe sexual fantasies. And I decided to go with it because I was so physically uncomfortable meditating. And I needed a break. You know, as they go off in fantasy land, and suddenly it kind of lifts them up out of their, you know, their discomfort. You know, like praise and blame from other people can affect your energy level. Our own thoughts can do the same thing. Thoughts can create physical tension. There's tentacles that go down to our muscles. And you can see that. Some people think really hard. And, you know, sometimes their eyebrows bunch up or their crunch up around their forehead. Or their jaws get all tense, or the shoulders or the neck. You can feel it in yourself, maybe some of you. Not everyone has the same kind of powerful connection between thinking and their butt muscles. Some people have a very close connection, some people don't. But people who have a close connection can often feel in their muscles. I can feel it sometimes, muscles below, kind of in my cheek and in my shoulders, I feel. Sometimes in my eyes. Sometimes it feels like I'm almost like I have a muscle inside my skull that kind of sometimes feels like it gets a little bit tight or pressure or has a lot of energy, blood coursing through it. Sometimes when I've kind of watched my mind kind of caught up in lots and lots of thinking, it just feels like somehow the structure in my brain is being reconfigured by all this thinking. And I said, oh no, I'm going to be hardwired now like this. And then I'll meditate for a while and it just kind of calms down. And I said, oh, thank God, it wasn't hardwired. Thank God, you know, it wasn't frozen that way. That would have been terrible. And it kind of all kind of, you know, settles out and relaxes. And then thinking is often connected to our beliefs. My guess is the bigger impact a thought has on us, the more likely it is it's connected to some belief. And sometimes there are beliefs that kind of are recurrent, they're always going on, kind of deep, sometimes subconscious beliefs that somehow are operating, we don't even see, a certain kind of thought that is operating. And so it's always there, chattering away, kind of reinforcing things. And some of those recurrent, ongoing beliefs are energy drains in themselves. And some of them are kind of boosting, or bring a source of optimism and hope. But what happens in deep meditation sometimes is you drop down to some of the more subconscious areas where some of the surface thinking kind of quiets down. And it's a real surprise to discover some of the deeper belief systems and the deeper kind of thoughts that are operating that create the structure or the foundation for a lot of other kind of thoughts you might have. So, for example, there's all kinds of kind of underlying kind of thought patterns that might be there. But one thought pattern would be, for example, that the world is a threatening place. You know, some people kind of operate with that assumption all the time. They're always kind of looking. Their assumption is that this world is a dangerous place. They've had maybe some really difficult experiences, you know, growing up that give them that idea that it's a threatening place, and so they're always on their guard. It's always there operating. Other people might have the underlying idea that the world is a benign place, it's a good place. Or they might have the underlying idea that this world is here for me. You know, just, you know, it's here to satisfy my whims and desires and wishes. And so what's in it for me? You know, it's kind of always, that's what's going on. It's all self-referential. Or an underlying belief that I shouldn't be here. I don't deserve to be here. You know, it was a mistake somehow. You know, some biological mistake, it's a theological mistake. Somehow, you know, all the other people, it's okay for them to be alive, but, you know, I shouldn't be alive. I shouldn't be here. And I've not met people who basically feel that way about themselves. And there's an underlying belief that's there. There's a thought that's there, that's somehow there. And it has a big impact on how we go around. And some people have thoughts of feeling that they're unworthy, or some people feel like they are super worthy, or some people feel all kinds of beliefs that operate, that go on. And these kind of more subconscious kind of thoughts, you know, all kinds of thoughts, are sometimes never scrutinized, never looked at. One relationship that people have to thinking is that every thought is believable. That somehow every thought is true. What would happen if you thought that, what if you assumed that every thought was not, what if you just thought every thought was just a thought? It wasn't true or not true, it was just a thought. You go to the bookstore and pull down a book from the bookshelves, and you open it to a page and read a sentence. Just a sentence. And you close and you put the book back and walk out of the store. And perhaps, you know, maybe the book you got was a book on, I don't know, thermodynamics. And you could barely understand the sentence you read. Just a sentence. You know, you don't pick it up, you don't do anything with it. Can you relate to your own thoughts that way? Or is there a typical to it from you to the thought? Where you feel like, oh, that's, I'm compelled to believe it, I'm compelled to go along with it. Some people seemingly live inside their thinking. The world of who they are is inside this, the world of, that's where they live. They take up residence in their thinking. And how they orient themselves to the world and see the world and everything is through their ideas and thoughts and opinions and views. And it's completely baffling to imagine that it can be any other way. But is there another way? Is it possible to step out of your thinking and then look at your thinking? Is that possible? Get some objective distance from it. Once, many years ago, when I was in college, I was living in an apartment that had a balcony. And two friends in the living room, and they were having an animated conversation about something. And for some reason, I went out on the balcony and closed a sliding glass door. And I looked back into the living room, and I could see them having an animated conversation, but I couldn't hear a word. And that was really amazing, to watch this animated thing without any words. But I was out on the balcony looking in. What's it like kind of to step out on the balcony? If you're in a, you know, big party and it's busy and, you know, lots of noise, and you're kind of in the middle of the fray and it's difficult to be in the socializing all these people you don't know, whatever, and then you step out on the balcony, close the door, and you look back at the party. It's a very different relationship to the party rather than being in the middle of it. Can you do that with your thinking? Can you leave the party? Step out? You know, I kind of actually on the veranda and look back and say, oh, look at that. As opposed to being in it, as opposed to being pushed around by them. Do you have such a place? Is there a place in your mind? Is there a veranda in your mind where you can step back and look, as opposed to being in the middle of it? And I think that's one of the things that mindfulness is pointing to, is that possibility of a way of being, a kind of awareness, which is not enmeshed or entangled with thinking, but has managed to disentangle it from it. Not to be for it or against thinking, not to be opposed to it, but to be free of it. And in being free of it, not being pushed by it, not believing every thought that arises, not giving in to every thought that arises, not chasing every thought that arises with another thought, another idea. But you know, there's a thought. To see a thought is just a thought. A memory. An idea of the future. Idea of yourself. This can be revolutionary to do this, because chances are pretty high that the sufferings of your life, some of the most important or core or deepest ways in which you suffer or have stress, has its genesis in some kind of thought, some kind of mental kind of activity that we call thinking or imaging or imagining. And if it has some close genesis to it or some close connection to that, if you have a different relationship to your thoughts, what happens to your suffering? I think one of the things that can happen for some people when they meditate is that before you meditate, you can feel like certain things are really important. And then when you sit and meditate, things relax and you get a whole different perspective on this issue. And you go, it wasn't so important after all. One of the things, one of the ways I get caught sometimes is if I have a lot to do, not enough time to do it in, oh, I've got to do all this stuff. I'm trying to do it all. And my mind gets kind of tight when that happens. And my mind gets kind of tight and claustrophobic, all the things I've got to do. Then it's so important to get them all done. If I don't get them done, it's going to be bad. Things are going to fall apart. It's going to be horrible. And what I've learned is when I get worked up this way, I've learned that it's really helpful if I stop and meditate. Like even for 10 minutes. And after those 10 minutes, I have lots of time. I don't understand. It's just really amazing what happens to time. Suddenly it seems like I've discovered more time. It's counterintuitive, right? To take time off to meditate when you've all stuff to do. So next time you really feel oppressed by time and you don't have enough time to do it all, sit down and meditate 15 minutes. And see what that does. Maybe it changes your perspective on it. So I'm talking on and on here. All these thoughts of mine. And what I'm trying to convey to you is what I said in the beginning, is that I think it's really helpful for meditators to spend some time studying the phenomenon of thinking. Explore it, get to know it well. And how it is for you. Each person's going to be different. What's your relationship to your thinking? Some people hate their thoughts. Some people love them. Some people believe every thought they have. Some people are repelled by their thoughts. There's all kinds of ways in which people relate to their thinking. Is it possible, in the best senses of the term, to have no relationship to your thought whatsoever? To be free in relationship to your thoughts? Just like you would have no relationship to a bird that flies overhead. There's the bird, just hardly notice it. The thought arises, you don't pick it up, you don't go for it, you don't let it influence you. Just kind of, just a thought. How free can you be of your thoughts? And who are you if you are not your thinking? Or who are you if you don't have your thoughts to tell you? Now that's a good one, I think. if you can't use your thinking to tell you to tell yourself who you are, who are you and how are you going to know? Is there some way of knowing who you are if you can't tell yourself? If you can't have a thought that tells you, or an image, or a vision, a visualization that kind of shows you? What? Who are you? I have this idea of, you know, like the mirror. And you want to somehow catch the mirror without your reflection. So you sneak up on it. You know, and you try to get there fast enough. You know, if you go really fast, then the reflection won't be there. But the mirror is there, right? The luminous, the shiny, reflective mirror is there, right? Sometimes it can be very hard to kind of catch yourself without having a thought that tells you. But it's possible. It's not as difficult as the mirror thing, which I guess is impossible. But and my suggestion is that if you can find some sense of yourself that is not mediated through your thoughts, you'll have access to a place that's peaceful. If you're going to mediate your life through your thinking, I suspect that sooner or later it's not going to be very peaceful. You're not going to have as access to as deep as peace as possible. So study your thinking. Get to know it. The way to work with obstacles is to get to know them really well. So in that sense, in this kind of practice, we are in a sense welcoming of the obstacles. Oh, great! I got a good obstacle today. Because now I get to study it, get to know it well. And that's the process of becoming free of it. So, we have 5 minutes. And do any of you have anything you want to ask about this? Or make comments? Or you all been silenced?
You said, you mentioned about when there's a recurring thought to turn around and look at that thought, to face it. When is it okay to continue focusing on the breath, and when is it okay to continue the analysis of where this thought is coming from?
Good question. There's no really the right answer for your question. I think a lot of it has to do with, again, your own understanding, your own exploration. And you try different things, you know, explore different ways, trial and error. Sometimes you try just ignoring it and just staying with the breath, seeing how that is for a while. Other times you might stop looking at the breath and look at the thinking and see what that's like, see what you can learn. But generally, it's a good, generally good advice in meditation is the first thing to do is just ignore it or let go of it and come back to your breath. And just come back and come back, let go and come back, let go and come back. And eventually things generally will tend to calm down or quiet down on its own. If a thought is really strong or persistent or recurrent, and you, even if you can, like, maybe you can't let go of it, or if you let go of it, it comes back right away or pretty quickly, then it's a sign that something's going on that you haven't understood. So then you want to let go of your breath and bring your full attention on this thinking, because it is so recurrent. The fact that it's repetitive is an indication that it needs attention. And then it's an art to know, you know, how long to pay attention to it, and how to pay attention in such a way that you don't get pulled into its world of thinking. So use the word analysis, which is a fine word to use. However, the word analysis for some people's mind suggests thinking about your thinking. And what we try to do in mindfulness is to look at it like from the veranda, and try to understand the different elements, but not by thinking about it, but more the silent awareness, more that side of it. Is that...
I was aware when you were speaking of a time of having a very strong thought and feeling sort of attached to it, that you go out to it, that your mind is sort of pulled to it this way. And I was thinking, no, it's not like that. It's more like the thought is attacking my mind. It's going in the other direction. That it's. I'm just sitting there minding my own business, and the thought comes instead of seeing it as something that I'm letting happen. So that, I thought that was interesting. But it's.
Yeah. It's very interesting to change the perspectives and loosens things up. So this world of thinking, as I said, is a very important one. And I would suggest that for some people, it's not everyone, you know, relates to thinking as a major thing they do. Some people are more feeling people, or kinesthetic people, or different ways in which, you know. But I want to say as a final word that for some people, thinking, if you've traced the roots of it, get down to the kind of the root or the heart or the kind of core area, subliminal or subconscious areas of thinking, it's really closely tied to really deep, fundamental, existential, personal, emotional, psychological issues, core issues of suffering. And the exploration of thinking, for all the humor we can take, we can use about it, you know, thinking about this Colorado Division of Wildlife and all that, I think that the encounter with thinking, a deep encounter with it, the deep, careful looking and thinking in a very deep way, silently, quietly, really giving it time to feel it, it's really helpful to do that with a lot of compassion. To meet it with you with a lot of self-compassion, a lot of compassion, a lot of care, a lot of kindness. And, you know, it's probably that place, the deep places of thinking, deep kind of core places of thinking that are the foundation for it all, probably have a tremendous need of our kindness, our forgiveness, our compassion in order to really be seen and met and healed. So certainly enjoy your thinking. Laugh at it when it's appropriate. If you've never laughed at your own thinking, it's about time. But also sometimes, you know, it's certainly not a laughing matter. And then meet it with your compassion. So thank you.